Mr. President, yesterday afternoon, in welcoming another distinguished guest who addressed us, I made mention that several young persons on his campaign staff were products of the B'nai B'rith youth movement. This morning, as splendid proof of B'nai B'rith's bipartisanship, I acknowledge the presence of another of our youth, a former AZA who now serves you in a capable capacity as a speech person. He is now special assistant to the president, our good friend Milton Friedman. And we're delighted that Milton is here with us. We regret that circumstances prevented two of the president's very close friends, members of the B'nai B'rith family, could not be with us. I have reference to Max Fisher, chairman of the Jewish Agency and a great leader in American Jewish life, and Milton Hoffman, a friend of long standing with the president, who had a death in his family, but sends his best wishes to the president. We regret exceedingly that Mrs. Ford could not be with us this morning, but she sends us her best wishes. Mr. President, I'm delighted to welcome you to an American tradition. B'nai B'rith is an American tradition that began back in 1843, when John Tyler, then the president, had to deal with what Gerald Ford must deal with today, the splendid torments of the presidency. In this bicentennial year, B'nai B'rith commemorates the American past with a sense of meaningful involvement. Our pride is pardonable. For 133 of the 200 years, we were, in Justice Holmes's words, part of the action and the passions of our nation. I do not attach any prophetic significance, Mr. President, that there actually was a B'nai B'rith just a few months before the Republican Party came into existence. But it is a pleasant indulgence to recall that a B'nai B'rith leader by the name of Abraham Jonas, he served at that time in the Illinois legislature, where he was the first to suggest and to politic for the presidential candidacy of his friend and fellow Republican, Abraham Lincoln. B'nai B'rith's institutional concern are naturally Jewish in origin, yet not parochial in purpose and benefit. As a Jewish movement in a free society, we are a part of and involved with, never isolated nor exempt from, that particular society. We believe the human condition is not sectarian. In the ultimate, it is indivisible. We are a voluntary organization, and in the American scheme of things, the voluntary organization is a majestic affirmation of democracy based upon the concept that the pursuit of happiness means the right of each of us to be himself or herself. We know that democracy isn't easy. It isn't self-generating. It isn't self-perpetuating. It has to be worked at constantly. And the voluntary organization helps democracy get its work done. Democracy shone in brilliance on July the 4th, 1976. Americans that day had a memorable birthday celebration, spectacular in scope. But the greatest spectacle was not the tall ships, the fireworks, the concerts, the parades, the community picnics. What was most vivid and most enduring, Mr. President, was the magnificence of the national mood. No official committee could have planned or arranged it, no matter how large the budget. It pervaded the nation. Huge crowds bound together in fellowship, in good humor, in tranquility and loyalty and tradition, in idealism and hope. In a disturbed and disturbing age, when confrontation and discord seem to dominate our lives, when violence is shrugged off as commonplace, suddenly there was national togetherness. It was a remarkable demonstration of patriotism, a patriotism of promise. Mr. President, that promise was to me personified in the television appearance of you, the President of the United States. You reminded us that day that beyond the contentions and the confrontations, the complacencies and the corruptions that are the imperfections of human society, that we are a nation of deep and enduring spiritual values and strength. Yes, on that day, Mr. President, you seemed to bound up the national wounds. We applaud your clarity of purpose, your striving to heal our nation's wounds. Throughout your long career of public service, you have been justly known as a man of integrity, a determined worker for freedom and human rights. And so, Mr. President, we welcome you this morning as a long-term friend of B'nai B'rith, a steady and reliable friend for over 25 years. For we recall that back in the early 50s, yes, right after the State of Israel was declared, you began to appear before B'nai B'rith lodges to talk about the relationship of this country to Israel. We know of your abiding commitment, not only to the future of Israel and to its people, but to the cause of Soviet Jewry and to the great cause of justice and freedom throughout the world. You have led our nation through a trying period as a living testimonial to a cynical world that our Constitution does work, that a free people can weather the severest of storms. And therefore, Mr. President, it is with heartfelt thanks and appreciation, great pride, that we are delighted and honored to welcome you to this convention. And ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the President of the United States.
Thank you very much, David. Ambassador Dinitz, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. At the outset, let me express my deep gratitude and appreciation for that more than generous introduction. And I understand, David, that you're unopposed this year in your campaign for the presidency of B'nai B'rith. David, you'll have to tell me how you do it. I am honored to address this convention saluting both the 133rd year of B'nai B'rith and the 200th anniversary of the United States. You, the sons and daughters of the covenant, have kept your commitment to Judaism and to America. As one of America's pioneer voluntary agencies, your seven candles have generated light and warmth and love. Your compassion illuminates the best of our nation's traditional spirit of voluntary service to others. Your devotion to family virtues and values makes me proud to serve as president of the great American family, of which the Jewish community is a cherished member. I have been meeting with B'nai B'rith for more than a quarter of a century, and always understood that you were a nonpartisan organization. I had prepared an appropriately nonpartisan speech for this morning. But when I saw the morning paper, I was disappointed to see that one of your speakers yesterday apparently kicked off our debates from this rostrum. As a matter of fact, I originally proposed that our first subject be defense and foreign policy, and that it should be held yesterday, September 8th. Mr. Carter rejected this arrangement. I guess he didn't want me to be present. Well, I got here as quickly as I could. Without objection, I'd like my turn at the plate. Number one, Mr. Carter told you, I have called for closer ties with our traditional allies and stronger ties with the State of Israel. I say to you, Israel is one of our traditional allies, and our ties have never been closer or stronger. As for our other allies, the gentleman has proposed troop withdrawals from Western Europe and from Korea, defense budget cuts that would cripple our ability to supply or sustain our friends, bans on nuclear tests by our allies, a nuclear strategy of massive retaliation policies which would invite a major crisis with our allies, including Israel. Number two, Mr. Carter told you, and I quote, I have stressed the necessity for a strong defense, tough and muscular, adequate to maintain our freedom under any conceivable circumstances. I say to you, the gentleman on other occasions has advocated defense cuts of $5 to $7 billion, delaying our strategic bomber program, withdrawing from overseas bases, and cutting off military aid to vital allies. I say to you, if we do any or all of these things, it would be impossible to have a defense adequate to maintain our freedom and the freedom of our friends. Finally, I seem to recall that the shepherd boy David was both tough and muscular. It's a good thing. He also had the most advanced weapon system of that day. Number three, the gentleman told you we have allowed virtually unlimited sales of arms to countries around the world, a policy as cynical as it is dangerous, end quote. I tell you, most of our arms sales and military aid goes to key countries like Israel and Iran. I assume he is not proposing to cut off Israel. Does the gentleman want Soviet arms to have a monopoly in the world? Does he want our adversaries to arm not only the radical Arabs, but also the more moderate Arabs? Does Mr. Carter honestly consider his own country's bipartisan policies more cynical and less moral than the Soviet Union's? And now, back to my nice nonpartisan speech. As America celebrates its 200th anniversary, there is a new maturity in our national pride. There is a new awareness that ours is a nation of many faiths and denominations, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, and others, all equally honored and all equally separated and protected from government by the Constitution of the United States. A fresh optimism grows from self-confidence and mutual trust, and from a reliable, stable, enduring philosophy of government, just as B'nai B'rith honors a sacred covenant, so does our nation at home and abroad. Ours is a covenant with freedom. As descendants of those who found sanctuary and fulfillment in this great land, we know that freedom is indivisible. Tyranny and terrorism abroad endanger freedom at home. We are our brother's keeper. Our own bicentennial Independence Day was enhanced by an event that day and Entebbe Airport in Uganda. That action of liberation freed our own hearts to fuller understanding of the universal meaning of independence and the courageous action sometimes requires to preserve it. A free people must never capitulate to terrorism. That is why I long ago asked for mandatory prison sentences for airplane hijackers. Certainty of punishment prevents crime. I have strongly urged international action to stamp out terrorism wherever it occurs. America has always been a land of new beginnings. Our ancestors who came to these shores made a new beginning. They saw America as a promised land. As we approach the Jewish New Year, many Americans know that we are making a new start in our national life. Something wonderful happened to America in the last 2 years. Together, we overcame a time of torment at home and abroad. Military involvements and economic threats, assassinations and wrongdoing in high places. We recaptured the spirit of 1776. We believe in the hopes of our revolutionary founders and our immigrant ancestors. We found new meaning in their vision of free men and free women enjoying limited government and unlimited opportunity. We renew our commitment to those less fortunate than ourselves. We know that the United States of America is sound. We are secure. We are on the march to full economic recovery and a better quality of life for all Americans. America's salvation is not in a revival of outdated social experiments financed by you who pay the taxes and obey the laws. I see no excuse whatsoever for arbitrary quotas on the basis of race, religion, or national origin in employment or education. In the name of justice for some, we must not do injustice to others. Opportunities should be open to all Americans on an equal basis. That is basic to the finest American principles of liberty and justice for all. When I became president 2 years ago, I pledged to be president to all of the people. I renew that pledge today and support it not with vague plans and vacillating promises, but with a proven record of performance. Two years ago, the scene was grim. Could we muster the unity and will to overcome our domestic turmoil? Could we stand up for freedom? We not only could, but we did. Today, not a single American is at war anywhere on the face of this earth. America is at peace and seeks peace for all countries. Look what has happened in the Middle East. The United States has helped bring about a momentum towards peace that has no parallel in Middle East history. Every American can stand up with pride for what this country helped to do. Two agreements were reached for the separation of forces on the Egyptian and Syrian front. Buffer zones were created to protect against a surprise attack. In every war between Israel and Egypt, its Arab neighbors, has grown out of surprise attack or fear of it. The forces of moderation, leaders who were willing to commit themselves to the peace process, were strengthened. The disruptive role of those opposed to the peace process has steadily declined. The United States has fashioned new institutions of energy cooperation with its major allies, including contingency measures to safeguard against a new oil embargo. America's important contacts with the Arab world grew again. The resettlement of cities along the Suez Canal and the clearing of the canal for international traffic gave practical evidence of a turn towards peace. Then, just a year ago, came the Sinai Agreement, a dramatic milestone, the first Arab-Israeli agreement that was not just an armistice in the aftermath of hostilities. It was a political as well as a military step. It was intended by both sides as a significant advance toward peace. In that agreement, both Egypt and Israel pledged that the conflict between them and in the Middle East shall not be resolved by military force, but by peaceful means. And they are determined to reach a final and just peace settlement by means of negotiations called for by the Security Council Resolution 338, and that they will not resort to the threat or the use of force or military blockade against each other. As a result, the danger of war and destruction was further reduced for both sides. Not a single young Israeli or a single young Egyptian has since died fighting on the Sinai. There is no precedent for the promise of lasting and just peace in the Middle East, which this agreement has opened up. Both Prime Minister Rabin and President Sadat believe the agreement is the possible turning point. Prime Minister Rabin, who has been my personal friend since he was ambassador here and I was in the Congress, reported to his parliament on June 15 this year, and I quote, "I note with satisfaction that during the past 2 years, relations between the United States and Israel have become closer. Our governments have arrived at a common approach regarding the desirable political direction on the road to peace and in the development of processes of peace. There has been no erosion in the position and in the attitude of the administration, the Congress, and the American public toward Israel. Relations between the United States and Israel remain firm. It will never be superfluous to emphasize and re-emphasize the feeling of gratitude and appreciation that the people, the Knesset, and the government in Israel maintain toward the United States for its stand on Israel's side," end quote. The negotiating process will continue. The progress made has withstood the dangerous conflict in Lebanon And I believe it helped to prevent that tragic warfare from spilling over into a wider confrontation. I intend to pursue further progress because it is right for America, right for Israel, right for the Arabs, indeed right for all the peoples throughout this world. I do not promise you it will be easy. I can tell you what I will do. There will be no imposed solutions. But agreements whose terms are hammered out between the parties, as in the Sinai Agreement. There will be no one-sided concessions. But a balanced quid pro quo in exchange for everything given up. We will proceed as we have in the closest constant consultation with Israel before, during, and after any negotiations. A strong Israel is essential to peace and to the national security interests of the United States. From the time I first ran for Congress in 1948, I recognized the justice of Israel's rebirth and its importance to the United States. I am proud to stand on my consistent 28-year record of support for Israel. You know where I stand. The funds I proposed for Israel in my first two budgets totaled over $4 billion for 27 months. These figures speak more eloquently than words. I am proud that my ambassadors at the United Nations have stood up and spoken out for the elementary principle of fairness that Americans believe in. I tell you now that we will fight any measure that condemns Zionism as racism. Or that attempts to deny Israel her full rights of membership in the United Nations. The United States will stand firm in its commitment to Israel's security and survival. America's policy of peace through strength has proven itself in the Middle East and throughout the world. Nobody questions our dedication to peace, and nobody doubts our willingness to use our strength when America's vital interests are at stake, and we will. A strong defense is the best insurance for peace. But our strength has never rested upon arms alone. It is rooted in our mutual commitment to the highest standards of ethics and morality. Take the Arab boycott as an example. This involves both moral and legal questions, domestic as well as international issues. It is easy to escalate emotionally, but not nearly so easy to resolve rationally. I opposed Arab boycott practices when I was in the Congress. I have always opposed discrimination. America was born as a refuge from discrimination. As president, I have taken the strongest executive action in American history against foreign economic practices that discriminate against American citizens. Last November, I set forth a detailed program of administrative orders and regulations now in force, which prohibit any discrimination in export transactions based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Our moral and legal opposition to the Arab boycott of Israel has been made forcefully clear not only to foreign governments, but to the American business community. This campaign, together with careful diplomacy and the efforts of individual U.S. firms, has resulted in the easing of boycott practices and an effective end to open discrimination. This morning, I reiterate my determination to make further progress, if necessary, by legislation so that government officials at all levels and the American people will know that I mean business. And I can tell you, I will continue to seek further progress on the issue of emigration from the Soviet Union. I raised it personally with General Secretary Brezhnev. I have discussed it on many occasions with my former colleagues in the House and in the Senate, with the determination to restore the prior rates of emigration. As a government and as a nation, we continue to stress the importance attached by all Americans to the basic human right to live where one chooses in this world today. A moral and ethical government promises its citizens no more than it can deliver, and delivers all that it promises. For too long, the American people have been promised panaceas for which we are still paying in credibility and in cash. My record is one of performance, not promises. My record is one of realism, not rhetoric. My record is one of experience, not expediency. Under our system in a national election, candidates will naturally disagree on political philosophy. That is why I was delighted when Mr. Carter accepted my challenge for a nationally televised debate on the real issues facing 215 million Americans. It is still my fervent hope that this campaign will be pursued in keeping with the best American traditions. America has no place for those who would set brother against brother, group against group, American against American. America did not rise to the heights. By catering to fear and to prejudice, we succeeded through courage, decency, common sense. We are all equal in the eyes of God. My administration will go on working for a better world. We have absolutely no reason to fear our adversaries abroad, as long as we remain strong and true to our principles. Our system has proven its superiority in every way. In remaining vigilant, we must never abandon our vision or our spiritual values. In the words of the New Testament, let us follow after the things which make for peace. Heeding still the Old Testament, which encourages us to seek peace and pursue it. As we must never lose our vigilance, neither must we ever lose our vision. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, I don't think that words can add to the applause you have just received. Certainly, the warmth of your message, your rededication to the principles for which B'nai B'rith stands, benevolence, brotherly love, and harmony, certainly were exhibited in your words. And we of the B'nai B'rith family would like to recognize your dedication to human rights as we present to you the first B'nai B'rith American Freedom Series Award. It contains with it not only a new medal which we have struck, but the George Washington letter to the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island, in which he spells out these words: bigotry, no sanction; to persecution, no assistance. Mr. President, you're an example of George Washington himself. May we present this to you, sir, with our compliments and thanks.
Thank you very much, David, and may I thank all of the members of B'nai B'rith here today and all of the many members of B'nai B'rith throughout the country for this very thoughtful and beautiful gift, which will be very meaningful to me in the years ahead. As I expressed, I've had a long and wonderful relationship with the local chapter of B'nai B'rith at home. I feel very deeply as to what your organization has done over a great many years. Betty wanted to be here this morning, and she asked me to supplement what David said, that she hoped you would understand and would accept her apologies. She has, as I think many of you know, many close and deep and wonderful friends among the Jewish community, and she's here in spirit, if not in person. Thank you very much.